You are listening to A Window on the Past on West Limerick 102 FM.
This week we're going to talk about a number of Gaelic attacks in Limerick.
Great.
Now, the attack on RIC barracks occurred, there's a period during which they occurred, essentially is the first 6 months of 1920. Like, essentially, you can divide the War of Independence into, dare I say it, slots. In 1919, there were a few kind of isolated incidents. Very little happened in 1919,
yes.
Particularly outside of a couple of counties like Limerick, maybe Cork, maybe Dublin. Right? Like in 1919, there was the Solihull big ambush on the 21st of January. That was the first incident. There was two policemen killed. Then in April that month, or that year, was it, you had the rescue of Robert Burns from the city home in Limerick.
Yes.
And which Burns was mortally wounded, and a policeman by the name of O'Brien was killed. The second half of then you had April, May, you had the rescue of Sean Hogan at Knockdown.
Yeah.
Now I have serious question marks about how Hogan even came to be captured. He was a young man, a bit headless, shall I say it, and always kicking over the traces. And he went off with a girl where he shouldn't have gone, and he ended up getting captured by the RIC, and the upshot was that two RIC men were killed at rescuing him, in the rescue of him in Knockdown,
yes.
In May 1919, and they said Dan Breen was seriously wounded, and all because of the headlessness of a young man. The second half of 1919, very, very little happened. There was shootings in Dublin, there was the Ashtown ambush, which the IRA attempted to shoot or assassinate Lord French, and there was also a number of DMP political detectives killed in Dublin.
Yes.
Now, as I say, that's really 1919. Very, very little happened. As I say, there were a number of shootings in Limerick, Tipperary, Dublin. Outside of that. And there was an ambush in Amoy in County Cork, where the IRA ambushed a church patrol. I think they were going to the Wesleyan Church in Amoy, and they were held up by the IRA, and some of the soldiers resisted, and one of them, a sergeant, was killed. As I say, that really was the summing of 1919. 1920, the first 6 months of 1920, saw a major change. There was attack on barracks, now RIC barracks. During that period also, many of the RIC, the smaller RIC barracks, were evacuated.
Right.
In the Limerick area, we'd say you had Ballinacora was evacuated, Ballineety was evacuated, Carrickandish was evacuated, Monaleen or Castletroy. Killone, Ballysimon and Castletroy RIC barracks were evacuated. Now, in the evacuation of Castletroy RIC barracks, or shortly afterwards, the IRA burned the barracks. Now, in most situations, the RIC barracks were burned by the IRA on the belief that they wouldn't be.
They wouldn't be used again. Was there something that precipitated this kind of change of events at the start of 1920?
The realization by the RIC and the British authorities that their smaller bikes were very vulnerable.
Much more vulnerable, and I suppose
to attack from the IRA.
A joint realisation, maybe, that this War of Independence might go on for longer than they imagined as well.
Well, yes, you see, it's a little bit like the thing in Ukraine today, where Mr. Vladimir Putin declares it a kind of a special military operation rather than declaring it a war.
Yes.
British, well, it's the same thing. They declared it a police action.
Right.
You know, and...
So from their perspective, it was a police action, but from the Irish perspective, it was a war.
It was a war, yeah.
Yeah.
And as I said, the RIC bore the brunt of it. Now, in March 1920, or in January 1920, the British realised that the RIC were run down. There'd been no investment and no recruitment. And a lot of Irishmen were feeling the heat and they resigned from the force. So they started to recruit in England. They had hundreds of thousands of ex-British soldiers, you know, back from the trenches, unemployed, you know. And a cynic once said, and unemployable.
Yes.
But anyhow, they started recruiting some of those as policemen to Ireland. They were known as the Black and Tans.
And we're just, aren't we, just past the anniversary of the arrival of the Black and Tans. Didn't they arrive in March?
The first ones arrived sooner.
Oh.
The first, better be very careful here. A kind of a pilot group were hired in January 1920.
Right.
About 10, 12. Now, one of them was sent to Galway. I can't think of his first name now. He wasn't the worst of them, but he was recruited and he was in Galway.
Yes.
Now, as I say, they started coming in numbers in March 1920.
So that, because that's the kind of date that you normally find in history books is kind of mid-March or thereabouts. But that's, I suppose, when they arrived en masse rather than, you know, the pilot group.
Yes. Now, the guy that set up the Black and Tans was actually from Fermoy. He was a district inspector. I cannot think of his name now offhand, but he was originally from Fermoy, and he went to England and set up a recruiting office in London. Now, the upshot was that most of the first Black and Tans came from the London area.
Right.
Because it's much easier for fellows in London to go to the recruiting office.
Of course.
Now, they changed that, or they expanded on that later in 1920. In July 1920, they were really using all the British military recruiting officers to recruit men for the RIC.
And dare I say it, we might say that they were focusing on quantity rather than quality.
Yes. Now, to be fair, you see, these people were totally unsuitable.
Yes.
You know, they were, a lot of them were young men that, when they had left school, they were shoved off to the trenches of France. They were brutalised there. I mean, with the best will in the world, they were totally unsuitable for being sent to a civilian policing situation.
And they were received back to their country after war as damaged goods with no supporting infrastructure in place for them.
There was no recognition. There was no recognition of suffering from shell shock. You know, like a man suffering from shell shock would be treated as a coward. Like, you can imagine the parallel I give you is you had Boris Johnson as the Prime Minister of England at the time called Lloyd George.
Yes.
Now, the parallels between Lloyd George and Boris Johnson, in my book, they're extraordinary. Neither man knew what the truth was.
Yes.
And if he did, he wouldn't be able to tell us. But anyhow, as I say, coming back to what we started out on, the first barrack attack, RIC barrack attack, that occurred in Limerick, occurred actually at Maru on the 24th, Saturday the 24th of January 1920. Now, I had, dare I say, the privilege of interviewing one of the participants back 40 years ago, Joe Graham. And he gave me an outline of what happened.
Yes.
Now, the first thing was, they isolated Maru. They would have companies, IRA companies around East Limerick, cutting down trees, blocking roads, so that, dare I say it, assistance couldn't come to the RIC in Maru. The next thing they did, of course, was they cut the telegraph wires. Anyhow, Maru had a very humorous sequel, right?
Yes.
The idea the IRA had was to place a mine at the gable end of the barracks in Maru. And this would be a kind of a very dangerous operation, because if the garrison were awake, they could open fire. But fortunately for the IRA, they weren't awake, and the mine was put in place, right?
Yes.
And it was camped in place with a land roller. Now, the man that made the mine, or that was responsible for the mine, was Bill Wall, a brother of Sean Wall's.
Very good.
And when Bill Wall had experience with explosives.
Yes.
Right? But what he didn't have was an order how to direct the explosion.
Oh,
so they put the mine in place. Now, the mine was actually constructed in Anacotti Creamery. Two or three people that were involved in the construction of the mine would have been Tom Minahan, O'Brien, he was from Owen O'Brien, Paddy Herbert. Now, he would be Michal Herbert's father, right?
Yes.
And they constructed the mine in Anacotti Creamery, and it was moved to Maru, and it was camped in place with a land roller. Now, they set the fuse, right?
Yes.
And ran back into cover, right? And the next thing, a few minutes later, or a few moments later, there was a massive explosion. And Joe Graham told me, this is very funny, when the dust cleared, all they saw was a scorch mark down the side of the gable end of the barracks. And the stone roller was in bits about 2 fields away. They didn't understand how to direct the explosion.
And of course, a dangerous thing to meddle with the explosions if you don't know how to direct them.
Exactly. Yes. Another thing the IRA found out about early 1920 was they didn't understand the properties of petrol.
Of petrol, we spoke about that.
They thought petrol was the same as paraffin.
The same as kerosene.
Had a slower burning time. Six IRA men to find out that it wasn't, but they found out with their lives.
But I suppose
like three men at Croom Courthouse in May 1921, and a number more in the courthouse in Drumcollar. Coming back to the RIC barracks, the barracks in Maru was evacuated sometime later.
Yes.
Because the British realised it was kind of isolated, as the IRA had proved, they were able to cut off the roads and take on the bikes, except that they weren't able to use the explosives properly.
Well, it could have been more costly for the IRA themselves. Like, they were fortunate that it just turned into a humorous incident. I suppose it's just indicative of the fact that we must always remember that the War of Independence was an amateur war. Like, they were dealing with things that they didn't have any knowledge or experience with.
A war by amateurs, I would say, rather than an amateur war. You know,
yes.
I suppose you could say the same thing, but it was, you're right, they were amateurs, right? They were finding out as they went along, sometimes...
And sometimes with deadly results. At a great cost to themselves.
Yeah, well, as I say, the cost certainly was in terms of using petrol. As I say, two examples being as some colour and as,
Croom. Yeah.
Now, anyhow, the next barrack attack was at Doon in March 1920. Again, the same tactic was employed, attaching a mine to the gable end of the barracks. And again, the mine worked all right, but it didn't damage the it didn't blew out the gable of the barracks. By April of that year, the IRA had changed their tactics.
Right.
There were two, dare I say, successful barrack attacks. One at Ballylanders at the beginning of April 1920, under the command. Now, there's always an issue about who was in charge at Ballylanders. Now, technically, the senior officer present was Sean O'Riordan from Kilmallock. But right. The man who was actually calling the shots, I think, on the ground was Tomás Malone. Now, as I say, there's often been a bit of conflict about that. Riordan was the battalion commander of the Galtee Battalion, but Tomás Malone was the officer on the ground. He was sent into Limerick as an IRA organiser because of a split in the IRA. We being in Limerick, there was always going to be a split, so we start things with a split, and then we walked from there. But Malone was sent into Limerick to heal the wounds of the split, and there it be said, he did. The attack at Ballylanders was a successful one, right? There was a garrison, I think, of a sergeant and six men. And what they did at Ballylanders, which was different to Maru or Doon, was they got on the roof of the barracks and they broke through the roof and poured in petrol. Now, this time, they knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing, yes.
And they set the place on fire. And eventually, they also were attacking from the outside, firing at the windows. Now, in this, one of the IRA men, he was seriously wounded. I can't think of his name offhand, but he was seriously wounded. He dropped his guard, and the RIC men, like, they're firing across the street at each other.
Yes.
It's very personal. They can see each other. They know who they are. And the IRA man presented himself, and the target and the RIC man, I think Stafford was the RIC man's name, he mortally wounded the IRA man. And as I say, that was at Ballylanders. Now, eventually, the RIC garrison was forced to surrender.
Right.
And the IRA captured the armaments, you know,
I suppose the mission when you're attacking a barrack is twofold, isn't it? It's to close the barrack, number one, and to capture any armaments you can, number two.
Yes.
The mission is twofold. It's not just about closing the barracks. You want to kind of restock your ammunition and capture any armaments if you can along the way.
Yeah. Anyhow, as I said, that was in Ballylanders in April 1920. Now, the biggest barrack attack mounted in Limerick was at Kilmallock on the 28th of May 1920. Now, in the meantime, as I say, our friend Sean O'Riordan had been captured.
Yes.
And there's no doubt that Malone was in charge in the attack on Kilmallock. And the IRA were again using the barracks in Kilmallock. Even though Kilmallock is a big town, was relatively how would I say it? It wasn't a dominant building.
Right.
It was overlooked to an extent by the hotel and the bank. Right. And the IRA were able to throw weights from one of those buildings onto the roof of the RIC barracks and breach a hole in the roof.
Weren't they were extraordinarily ingenious in the methods they came up with. You know, for as we said, amateurs who had very little equipment and very little weaponry available to them, they used what they had.
They had, and they learned fast. As I say, the trying to breach the gable with explosives didn't work at Maroon and it didn't work at Doon.
But what had been successful then at Ballylanders was getting onto the roof and breaching the roof and pouring in petrol.
Breaching the roof.
Yeah.
Now, the same happened at Kilmallock. You know, at Kilmallock, they breached the roof of the barracks. Now, there was a much stronger garrison in Kilmallock. There was two sergeants and ten constables, I think.
Yes.
So there was a 12-man garrison at Kilmallock. Now, there was Irie men brought in from outside places. There was some Irie men from West Tipperary. There was actually a man from Waterford, George Lennon. He's from Dungarvan. He took part in the attack in Kilmallock, and there was Liam Scully from Dencairn, County Kerry. Now, Scully was an unusual character. He was a Gaelic League teacher in East Limerick, and he was attached to the IRA, and he took part in the attack at Kilmallock. Now, he was also the only fatality.
Right.
Apparently, at the end of the... towards the end... Now, the attack started around midnight, which I would say is probably a bit late. But anyhow, as I say, they didn't manage to dislodge the RIC. The barracks was blazing. Now, blazing is what I would use.
Yes.
There was a sergeant and a constable Morton killed in the attack. Now, apparently they were thrown into the barracks, and they died, I'd say, more from burning.
Burning than just from being unable to escape the building rather than... Yes.
Now, there was a reinforced shed out the back, and the rest of the garrison escaped into that, and the IRA were not able to capture the arms, and they wouldn't have to push home their advantage.
Right.
And as I say, my belief is the attack started too late, because in late May, you're talking about shorter, it's a shorter night.
Yes.
So if you don't start until the attack until about 11 o'clock or midnight, you don't have too many hours to presume your advantage.
Sure.
And that happened, as I say, at Kilmallock, that they kind of had to lift the siege without actually
Without completing the
garrison. Now, there was a Sergeant O'Sullivan in charge. Now, he's an interesting character in the sense that he's from County Galway.
Yes.
And from an RIC point of view, he inspired a resistance. The IRA were not able to capture the garrison. And O'Sullivan was credited with mounting a resistance to the IRA. And he got promoted to a head constable, and he was moved to Stowell in County Kerry.
Right. Well, I know that we're looking at this, obviously, from the Irish point of view and from the Republican point of view within the context of the War of Independence. But, you know, you have to admire shows of bravery like that, too, don't you? He did not surrender.
He didn't surrender, no. And as I said, Tobias O'Sullivan was his name. And in the Stowell, right, you see, there was a belief that he was going to be brought to Spike Island to unmask Tomás Malone.
Right.
Tomás Malone had been captured, right? Now, he went under the alias of Sean Ford. And the British, because some IRA men had made a stupid mistake in Spike Island, the British knew that they had Malone.
But they didn't. They didn't know which man he was.
So apparently, the belief was that O'Sullivan was going to be gone. He would have known him because he was an East Limerick.
Sure.
That he was going to be brought to Spike to unmask Tomás Malone, and that Con Brosnan, great Kerry footballer of the late 20s, he was the man responsible for shooting O'Sullivan in Church Street in the Stowell.
Right.
Now, it's very sad in a way because O'Sullivan's son was actually with him, I think, close to him when he was shot.
Well, you see, the war and all wars, as we always say, is full of human story after human story.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
In you have the broader context, but you have the smaller, the human, the family stories within it as well, which always make it sad and difficult. We're going to have to, I suppose, leave it for there today, Tom, but we might come back to this next time. You have been listening to A Window on the Past on West Limerick 102 FM.